anyone would like to ask or share something.
Sensations during meditation. A teacher once told me that when you start getting heavy and you feel like tingling sensations, it's like, oh, that's just your cells getting H2O.
So the sensations in meditation, if you feel heavy and tingling, then it's...
Then he said, like, it's just your cells not having enough oxygen and they're slowly dying, so that's not good. So...
Maybe.
What do you think?
Well, I'm curious, how is it for you to, with your experience and then that idea, how does that go? Do you feel heavy and tingling sometimes?
Yeah.
And afterwards, what do you notice in your body?
If it's like similar with sleeping, but if your body's sleeping and it's also dimming, you cannot really feel it. But so, I don't know what that is.
Could you hear some? No? So I asked her how it is for her. If she feels sometimes heavy and tingling afterwards, she feels. More relaxed, you said, I think. I guess there's probably a lot of different kinds of heavy and tingling. like, if my leg falls asleep. But when I hear the two descriptive words, heavy and tingling, I get a really different sense than death. Something other than death seems to be.
What is tingling?
Tingling. What's tingling? Do you know tingling? Kind of, but it, I mean, it's a funny word. What does it mean, tingling? I don't know for sure, but I experienced the word tingling as a little bit vague because it could mean a few different, very specific sensations to me. So tingling could be if your leg falls asleep afterwards, when the nerves are coming back, so that could be called tingling. There could be tingling of more like if you get like that. It's a sensation that, depending on the context, could be pleasant or unpleasant. There could be a tingling in the throat. it's interesting to even stop and think about what tingling is, because it is maybe exactly something that we've all experienced many different kinds of. But in the moment, like if you have tingling in your throat, it could then become this whole subject of like, oh, I need to cough, I don't want to be loud, let me feel that more widely, relax, and then it changes. Or it could be a really like, feeling, tingling. So we could like if there's the kind of chills that could go through, or the hair on end feeling a bit. We could take it as like, oh, pleasant, or ugh, unpleasant. It's interesting. What were we gonna say?
I'm not going to do, I wanted to do the action, but I'm not. I also said, yeah, it's just blood pressure. It was very hot there.
Like, it's just low blood pressure when there's heaviness and tingling?
Yeah. It was very practical.
Very practical?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So we could kind of think through it in this way. That many times also the breath and the heart do get very slow or even stop when everything gets very quiet. And there can be fear of death. I don't know, I mean, never heard of anyone actually dying from meditation, but maybe we would never know. But there is some kind of... like for the biology, there's some tension there. And for the psychology also, some tension of what is that edge that we're relaxing into? Because life doesn't stop, but breathing stops for a longer time than we're used to. Sometimes the heart might sometimes stop for a longer time or change the rhythm. And so maybe we can say, yes, it's the cells are deadening, but happily, towards falling into a place beyond the biological programming, like survival. So maybe we can put it that way, and then we can agree with your teacher. That it could be a good kind of deadening towards bigger life. Okay? Anything else? So yesterday we were talking about having permission and also having the authority to offer or discover permission for the deeply natural to kind of take over or like run through us. And we could also think of this in terms of having freedom, so permission, freedom. Having authority to give freedom to the deeply natural. And what that is, it's like a... It's something like as if we always were walking along like this, and then something wants to go like this. And we would think, yeah, but how am I going to get around in the world if I'm like this? It doesn't make any sense. It's so different. It's so, like, we can't figure out how that could possibly survive if we're turned out of our usual way of approaching things. And so let's say an example of having freedom, accepting the freedom that we have. There's a kid's story where there are two kids, a girl and a boy, and two horses. And all four can talk. And all four are kind of creatures, characters who were born free, but then ended up kind of enslaved or in some kind of servitude. So the horse was kidnapped from freedom and made into a war horse, the one of them, and one was also kidnapped and domesticated, like taken as a, to be owned. One boy also was sent down the river and found and then taken as a servant. And the girl came from a higher class family and ran away because she didn't want to marry the guy that she was supposed to marry. So she's the only one who had the outer freedom, and she, that outer freedom being in the higher class, was also the unfreedom of having to follow the rules very well. So that kind of quality of looking for the kaccha, the uncooked, the raw, bringing rawness into a situation, the freedom that rawness can give, like in the concert of Keith Jarrett. That it's not too well organized. It's not too smooth, slick. And this group of two horses and two kids knew that sort of the bad guys were doing a surprise attack on the good guys. They were the only ones who knew, who could save the day. And they were going as fast as they could across the desert to try to bring the news. And it was really hard going. But they were also trying on their way to escape to the good guys. So they had every reason to want to get there and also make sure the good guys stayed free. Does that make sense so far? And they got across the desert and they got to the water just barely. And they took a break and they said, oh, we'll just have a little rest, a little break. And then they fell asleep and each of them kept thinking, oh, we really should go, we really should go. But they didn't. And so by the time they woke up, they had to really hurry to get there in time to bring the news. Watch out, a surprise attack is coming. And they were going as fast as they could go, they thought. Which wasn't quite as fast as they could go, and it wasn't quite fast enough. And so this is just a story that an author made, and the story was written around the time of World War II in Europe, and I think it was a commentary on having freedom. And so in the story, they're losing ground, the bad guys are catching up. They genuinely do think they're going as fast as they can, and they actually aren't going as fast as they would go if someone were on their backs, like whipping them to go faster. And so they're just getting to the first sort of haven where there's someone who could tell them where to find the king of the place to tell them what the attack is coming. And this lion comes out of nowhere and is about to attack, and suddenly the horses find more speed. And so it's just a trick of the author to point out how much of our resources come together when we're afraid, when we feel under threat, and we really are running for our lives. Even if always there's some way that the flow of life has that quality of life or death. But when it's not in our face, we can lose track of that sort of. How each moment has a kind of life or death quality. And later it turns out that, of course, the lion was actually some sort of incarnation of some sort of wisdom who specially showed up so that they could get there in time. And specially then accompanied just the one child who had to go on by himself to bring the news. the child not knowing that this lion is actually keeping me from falling off the edge, keeping me awake because I hear something breathing next to me and I'm terrified. And he gets the news to the king just in time, and then he goes on. Not quite meaning to, he gets lost, but he goes on. He ends up going on to the next kingdom to tell them, your neighbors are being attacked. And he tells the first people he sees, you know, they're being attacked. And it's a land where everyone's free. And so all the creatures say, yeah, someone should probably do something about that. I guess someone should probably tell someone about what's happening next door. But no one actually does anything for quite a long time. And then finally someone sort of calls the fastest creatures together and tells them what to do, and the good guys win. So for us, I think the pull towards convenience. What's convenient? What's convenience in terms of? It's a really, really good word to try to figure out what is it. Yeah, so it's actually even in also the English. What do we mean by convenient? So it's not only just what's pleasant, because often it ends up not being pleasant. In a way, it's what's addictive, we could say. What kind of puts us to sleep. So a small example, and the whole question of guilt and responsibility and responsiveness comes up here. So I don't want anyone to be thinking that I want you to feel guilty. That you might feel, but don't blame me for it. Don't blame yourself either. But a convenience is that there's hot water in the morning. So it's not super convenient. More convenient would be have hot water in the bathroom, or closer to the bathroom, or in the shower. So always it could be more convenient. And that's the United States of America. Always it could be more convenient. And because it could be more convenient, we end up putting any extra energy that we have towards making it more convenient. So then there's not just hot water in the bathroom coming out of the shower, but you can exactly program the temperature, and it's always there. So then that huge container of hot water that's 500 meters away in the other part of the house, there's no thought of anymore of how ridiculous it is. Ridiculous. And then, oh, what should we do about global warming? I feel so guilty. But there's not even a question anymore of whether we need to have however many gallons, which is however many 4 times liters, always ready. And so if it could come up as a question, as an unease, the movement towards convenience, and is it, and how will we know, the question of the week, how will we know if it's worth that energy? And at what point has it gotten so convenient that we don't even feel the hot water anymore? We don't actually enjoy it. That's what I mean about it's not necessarily even pleasant anymore. The way it can be to have a hot bucket that almost because it's too hot, too cold, because you had to carry it, because it smells like smoke or whatever. It's so good. Or it's actually not worth it. And then the cold water is like, oh, so good. After the first 2 cups. The third cup is like, yeah, bring it on. Or not, whatever, but it's so hard for us to kind of keep track. If only we would use that part of us that wants to keep track for this. How much energy is going toward the convenience And is there any benefit in it in terms of enriching our life? Or is it actually making it just washed out and pale and the opposite of rich? So having freedom is where there's the freedom to feel the hot water. There's the freedom to not go for the hot water. The freedom is, the hall is here all the time. The freedom is, no one is making you go. Some of you might have been on retreats where they make you go. And that has its place, I think, sometimes. Also, I think it has its place, no one is making you go. No one is congratulating you for coming. And when it's 24 hours, there really are times of day where no one is watching. And also the freedom that the hall is everywhere. The bench is the hall. No one is watching you go to the bench. No one is making you go to that bench. No one is congratulating you for going to that bench, which is your meditation hall, your meditation. So the Tibetan teaching of the four faults of the nature of mind, we had too easy and too close. And I want to build on that, and today it's too deep. But still staying a little bit longer with the too close, which is also too easy and too deep. It's not actually separate, like, factors. It's together. So yesterday I was talking again about this banquet table and our close ones, the closest ones in our life, in our psyche, being there to welcome us, waiting for us without impatience. And we may not know who those close ones are till we would get there, actually, because it's so hard to know. Partly because we're so protected from actually feeling that closeness, that we feel close with so-and-so. Somehow it could be an embarrassment, or it's so close, our protection, our defense won't let us feel it. But we can still play around with this idea of close, which is, as it's a word, it's only a metaphor for something. It's a pointer towards something. There's not actually like a location that's, you know, like too close. Here you are, you made it. You can high-five the sign. You got too close. Like, there's not a place. It's a metaphor, of course. But we could play around with when we feel close to someone. We have a close friend, or we had a close conversation. Where you feel what in your body? And when it was a really close, lifelong friend, you've known the person such a long time, what's that like? Or when you have a close conversation with someone you know you're never going to see again, and that's part of why it was such a close conversation. Something could be kind of unveiled or revealed because you're probably not going to see that person again. And so sometimes in my extended family, I'm the crazy cousin who lives somewhere over there. And so sometimes I know more about people's secret lives than their close ones know, because it's easy to tell me. They're not going to see me until next summer for one day, or not even a day, 1 hour. Or a feeling of either being kind of giving up, and what sort of drops out, that you just suddenly, there's a knowing. Or you feel quiet. and something just drops out, and there's a knowing. We can kind of rewind and feel the feeling of that falling. We didn't want to know. Now we know. So just one possibility is starting to feel afterwards, maybe, when you feel close or you feel gratitude or you feel appreciation, where and what do you feel? Just getting to know the feeling of closeness, in case that helps remind us that we're allowed to feel close. Permission to feel what is even more close than close. Even more friendly than any friend we have. And similarly, we could just feel, what do we mean by deep? And so sometimes we could just sort of, all right, go as deep as you can right now. Feel as deeply as you can in yourself. Does that make any sense? Does something happen? Do you go somewhere inside in some way? Even though we couldn't describe how we travel or exactly where it is, maybe. Or maybe we can say, yeah, it's like right here. Or it's way back here. It may be connected to body, it may not be. But that's something that we could kind of trust enough to play with. What do you mean when you say, okay, that was really deep? Or I want to just go really deep. What's the movement? What happens? What's the gesture inside? Or when we feel deeply moved or deeply touched, like maybe broken open to the core. Or we let something come into our bones. What's that? Sometimes if there is some kind of joy or openness, excitement comes, and it's a kind of sometimes almost we're used to getting rid of our extra energy instead of letting it gather. We feel excited and we want to show someone, did you see the moon or the stars or the... And just kind of turning that back in, soaking in, absorbing in, as if into the bones, or maybe into the bones literally. Also, when we feel kind of a deep unease or we feel troubled, so we've been going along with our nice thing and then something isn't quite right. We don't know what. And it's not that same old thing of not enough, something's wrong with me, something's wrong with the world. Some other kind of earthquake. Where do we feel what? What is that feeling? Or a deep longing. Sometimes people feel a deep longing, not everyone does. It's nothing wrong with you if you don't. Nothing wrong with you if you do. But if you do, what is it? Longing, like a... I think in Castilla it's anhelo.
Deseo.
Yeah. Pero en desech... What is it in Catalan? Yeah, anhel. Es mes anhel. When there's a longing, like what's moved towards what? And what do you feel physically if you feel something? Just checking from time to time. And we could also play with this, it's almost like if we have these different colors or media to play with. So that what's the texture or feeling of, what's the experiential texture, location of closeness as a metaphor, but also an experience? And what is the experiential texture or feeling of deep? Deeply moved, deeply touched, deeply troubled, deeply longing, for example, or just deep. What is that for you? And then ease. Even just the word, what happens in the body, body, mind. And then how could those, if those were like three piles of these rangoli kolam colors, how could they come together in a way that's not just like mushing together and making maybe a nice gray. But how could those three quality experiential feelings, deep, close, ease, easy, start to come together in a way? That maybe is softening and strengthening in you. And so, what I understand and notice about deep, too deep. What could be too deep for us to get, to understand, is that there starts to be a way that there's a different kind of movement, a different way of being moved, the body and the mind, and the life. There's a different beginning of the movement and a different way of being moved, a different way of accepting that being moved. So one of the ways that happens are these deep questions, where assumptions that have been with us for a long while start to kind of pop open and fall apart. And one of them is about, I already mentioned convenience, also our kind of orientation, like grid, that pleasant is good, unpleasant is bad. Pleasant means I'm doing well, unpleasant means I'm doing bad. That assumption doesn't match our experience, and gradually our experience starts to help the assumption fall apart. And so, mostly for a lot of us, spending more time just simple with the body helps allow this to happen, this falling apart, like an old cloth bag, and whatever's inside starts to be revealed. The assumption starts to disintegrate. And so we have this tendency to think all the time, oh, it's going well, or it's not going well. Or, oh, I'm so lucky, oh, I'm so unlucky. Or someone else was so lucky or unlucky. And so there's that wonderful kind of story that's kind of for children, but really also for adults, or even a game, fortunately, unfortunately. Do you know that game? As a game, it's just that we would each take turns saying a line and we alternate, fortunately, unfortunately. Fortunately, you made it safely to India. The next person's turn would have to be, unfortunately, they had taken away 500,000 rupee notes and hadn't replaced them with anything. And so I couldn't change money at the airport. And then fortunately, the taxi driver took a credit card or took 500 or whatever. Unfortunately, whatever. So it's our days that they happen that way. But questioning, since it does keep alternating, what is fortunate and unfortunate if each thing leads to the other? And so today, for some reason, it keeps coming to my mind, some kind of story that we could tell. We could tell the story of Noah, or Manu with the flood? We could tell the story of Manu or Noah as fortunately, unfortunately. Like, let's say from the point of view of, is it Manu or? I'll just call him Manu. Or the guy. There's a guy whose child is like, fortunately, you know, I have a good family, parents, brothers and sisters, and we live in a lovely village. Unfortunately, one day my father met this fish, and started talking to it. My father started to go a little bit crazy. But fortunately, he brought the fish home, and it was really kind of a beautiful fish. Unfortunately, the fish grew really, really big. Fortunately, they managed to get it to the ocean just in time. But unfortunately, my father still was crazy and started building a boat in the middle of the village, and everyone made fun of him. Fortunately, it was fun to learn carpentry or whatever, how to build a boat. Fortunately, at least he forgot about the fish or whatever. Unfortunately, there came a flood. Fortunately, we had the boat. Unfortunately, we couldn't get it off the ground. Fortunately, the fish came along and pulled the boat, etc. So just things keep happening, and we don't have much context for what's going to happen or why. And so we get more relaxed about our assumptions and our fortunately, like, fortunately, unfortunately, like the drama drains away instead of our energy draining away with the drama. So there's a saying that is supposed to be an Ojibwa saying, which is one of the Native American peoples, cultures. But I think it's one of those like sort of hippie New Age sayings. Who knows where it comes from? Maybe it's Ojibwa. But it's lovely, and on days like today with the wind, especially so. Sometimes I go about pitying myself. So to pity is to feel sorry for myself. Yeah? Sometimes I go about pitying myself, feeling sorry for myself, when all along great winds carry me across the sky. And we can start to feel that there could actually be another way of living that has no reference to fortunately, unfortunately. It has no reference to a storyline. It's not organized around a storyline. My interpretation that I'm telling myself, how I'm doing, what's happening, where I'm going, why I'm going there. That the sort of human meanings that cluster around everything in our lives, every mind state and every object and every tiny bit of food, every act like swallowing or peeing or whatever, it all has its clusters of human meanings. And that's just sort of, we can watch it ride by on the wind next to us, but we're not clinging to it to carry us. It's not what's carrying us anymore. And so there starts to be this possibility, and to me this is one way of talking about what's deep, is no one's watching. There's not any need, let's say, in the singing, if you've been doing that with us, to leave the belly while singing, just singing and belly. And noticing when we're not in the belly, and we're fiddling around with, am I pronouncing it right, or did I remember the words right, or am I off tune or on tune, or how does it sound at all whatsoever? And just belly. Or coming to the hall, walking around. Some other motivation, some other kind of nudge into movement, then how does it look? Then how am I doing? That doesn't have the kind of logic that we would like things to have. And when we stop requiring things to have the logic we think things are supposed to have. We stop assuming that things will have someday some logic that we expect. And we question that assumption that there should be logic. instead of questioning the events that don't follow the logic. So my mind is all over the place again after I was so peaceful. Unfortunately. Is it? How do we know it's unfortunate? And so it's not that there's not necessarily meaning, and it's not that there's not necessarily even understanding, but it's a completely other kind of understanding from what we are looking for. And one way to think of it, which again, it's all metaphor, especially when we talk about it so deep, we're just pointing with metaphor beyond metaphor. We can't actually touch it. But one way to think about another motivation and another kind of understanding, another kind of meaning, is that that new understanding happens like cells first, but head last. The head will be the last to know what it meant. Or what we would say about it in our human references and language. We find out afterwards, later, sometimes 10 years later. I'm not exaggerating. And so the possibility of why not go ahead and get into what later we'll be happy to know happened, rather than kind of demanding or hoping that we could get that thing to happen now before we dive in, like just diving in deep. But so deep that we don't know how deep. We're so deep that we've lost the chance to measure if we're deeper, deepest. So another kind of movement. Maybe a kind of example and metaphor could be the story of Rumi, who is said to be the one who started the tradition then of turning of the dervishes. And the story is that he was in a marketplace where the goldsmiths were working on the gold. And the sound of the hammering, instead of, maybe we can find a way to, now that the quarry has opened again. If you just arrived for this third retreat, this might be the first time you're hearing the noise of the rock work, because they had such nice long Pongal holidays, which was a lovely break for those of us who were living with that music before. But so Rumi was in this, the sounds of the goldsmith's market, and not hearing it according to the kind of cluster of human meanings, like marketplace and gold and noise, money making, kind of whatever we could think of that could come around that, how we would think of gold market, working on gold to sell. But something in him heard it as a kind of music, and that he just started turning in harmony with that music. And then the turning also was powerful to experience deeper and deeper, inner and outer as not separate, specific and, you could say, global or vastness or universal or cosmic as part of that turning together. And then it's sort of cool that that jazz, that Zen transmission of turning could then become a tradition, could become a technique that some people probably do and they just do and they try to get it right. And other people do and they may fall into an experience. And that the word dervish apparently means doorway. So letting all of our techniques, knowing that just as technique, it's superficial, it's not deep. But letting it kind of rhyme and resonate with our potential for natural alignment, deeply natural movement into some alignment that has, it's like moving into a different element. We're used to walking on the earth and suddenly we're swimming through the air and we're swimming through the earth. It's like moving through a doorway by following through on something that happens that might seem crazy, doesn't make sense. Being moved and just turning around and around, like. Feeling the power and dignity of how even something that crazy can be a doorway that actually then becomes an ancestor to people of the later generations. Becomes a doorway for other people too, potentially, a gift. Coming into a doorway, an experience where not watching myself, not being watched, not coming up for air, what's the storyline, what's happening, but just staying down in the belly. As if we're in a different world, different element, different law. That we could call it law of generosity, maybe. Accepting the richness of everything. And by accepting it, we're enriched and enriching. Is there any question or anything to share? Feel free. So when there is the ongoing storytelling of how I'm doing and how I'm not doing, and when that is happening, because it has its momentum, it'll keep going for a while. Even if we stop, even if we could unplug it immediately, it would roll along for a while. And since we don't know where to unplug exactly, it may go on sometimes for a long time, sometimes very loud. And so it's not a big fight to try to get it to stop and then we'll be okay. But even while that storytelling is going on, maybe some sense of humor about how it keeps saying, fortunately, unfortunately, fortunately, unfortunately. And we know we have no idea. And that having no idea could be deep. It could be deeper than having an idea. It could be more generous than having an idea. And also that maybe there already is that lake of deep in you, in us, that already kind of either belongs to you or you belong to it, already here. And not by scrambling that we get wet. Some kind of little bit of trust, little drop of trust can be enough to just, what if I don't know and that is okay? Splash. What if I just don't feel like fighting and that's not a problem? And then, even though we decided not to go to the meditation, the body just walks there anyway. And that's also not a problem. I'm not going crazy. Something that could move with all our resources without being whipped or frightened into it. So Ryokan, the one who was famous for his calligraphy, but usually didn't have enough money for brush or ink, and yet people were constantly trying to get him to do them a calligraphy because they were so valuable. And more than once, there would be a child who had paper and would find Ryokan. He loved to play with kids. And the child would say, do me a calligraphy. And one time Ryokan said, what are you going to use this for? So before saying yes, what are you going to use it for? And the child said, I'm going to make a kite. And then Ryokan said, okay, cool. And he did four characters, which is sky above, great wind. And told him, good. The child wanted to have something that could just spread out. Sky above, great wind. As long as you're not using it for some business or some other reason, some human reason, just no reason, just to play. Sky above, great wind. Not even an answer to any question. Just sky above, great wind. Some other law, some other element, some other movement, some other being moved across the sky. Thank you for your listening. May all beings be peaceful in our ups and downs as we're carried across the sky. May our practice and lives dedicate themselves to what's important, the stream, the momentum of awakening offering itself to all beings, including ourselves.